From Foreign Policy, I'm Sarah Wildman, and this is the ER. Today, American torture.
Left hand, raise your right hand, repeat after me. I, Gina Haspel, do solemnly swear.
The CIA made history recently as it welcomed its first ever female director, Gina Haspel. She was confirmed in May by a 54-45 vote in the Senate. Vice President Mike Pence swore her in.
So help me God.
But Haspel's glass-ceiling-shattering achievement was overshadowed by her involvement in one of the CIA's biggest scandals, the torture of terrorist suspects overseas, and the destruction of videotapes documenting the abuse. In 2002, Haspel managed a secret CIA detention facility, a black site in Thailand, where two Al-Qaeda suspects were waterboarded, one before she arrived and one after. This fact was brought up repeatedly during her confirmation hearings.
Do you believe in hindsight that those techniques were immoral?
Senator, what I believe sitting here today is that I support the higher moral standard we have decided to hold ourselves to.
Can you please answer the question?
Senator, I think I've answered the question.
No, you've not. Do you believe the previous techniques, now armed with hindsight, do you believe they were immoral? Yes or no?
Senator, I believe that we should hold ourselves to the moral standard outlined in the Army Field Manual.
Director Haspel has vowed to never use these techniques again, even if she's commanded to by President Trump.
I have spoken as recently as 24 hours ago with people at the highest level of intelligence, and I asked them the question, does it work? Does torture work? And the answer was yes.
Well, the use of torture, or what was called enhanced interrogation techniques, reopened a national debate, often overlooked are the lengths in which the previous two administrations hid details about the true nature of the CIA program. Meanwhile, a false narrative has taken root that mistreatment of detainees yielded critical intelligence, like the location of Osama bin Laden. That narrative persists today. It's been repeated by politicians and in highly acclaimed films, like 2012's Zero Dark Thirty.
Where was the last time you saw bin Laden? Where was the last time you saw bin Laden, huh?
You know, when you lie to me, I hurt you.
The truth of what actually happened in those secret prisons, those black sites, is contained in a 6,700-page report written by the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. That was a culmination of thousands of hours of work, mainly by two staffers serving under committee chairwoman, Senator Dianne Feinstein. Daniel Jones was the lead investigator and author of the report. He's with us now. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So with the nomination of Gina Haspel and the confirmation of Ms. Haspel for the directorship of the CIA, we've reopened a conversation about torture that you were deeply involved in with the creation of the torture report. I want to talk to you about how the torture report came about. How did you start working on this?
I came to the committee in January 2007. Prior to the Senate Intelligence Committee, I was at the FBI for about 4 years. I came to the committee to do oversight of counterterrorism matters and the FBI, and I sort of became the person who did investigations on the committee. In December of 2007, Mark Mazzetti of the New York Times broke a story that the CIA had destroyed over 90 videotapes of CIA interrogating detainees at their first detention site.
And the tapes of the CIA interrogations were of a specific interrogation, or it was a Brown 1 specifically, wasn't it?
It was two CIA detainees, a detainee named Abu Zubaydah and Al-Rahim al-Nashiri.
And what happens when that tape destruction is made public?
So comes to light, the tapes are destroyed in December. The committee said, okay, well, what's our value add? And they decided to take Michael Hayden up on his offer, the CIA director at the time, who said this wasn't obstruction of justice. We destroyed the tapes, yes, but we have a written record. And if you'd wanted to see the tapes, we would have shown you those. In this case, we have the written records. So we'll show you them. That was in December. At the time, it was Chairman Rockefeller who was leading the Senate Intelligence Committee. He sent myself and another staffer out to the CIA. We had two Republican colleagues who did the same. to go look through those materials. And with the documents we had were probably, like, if you're old enough to remember, old Encyclopedia Britannicas, mm-hmm. like two sets of those.
How many pages was it?
Oh, thousands.
And it wasn't like you were looking through piles of paper. You were looking at it on a computer screen.
These were cables. They were piles of paper, actually, okay. in this case. Yeah. You know, we didn't get to the computer screens until later. In this case, they were redacted documents. Mm-hmm. We received these in paper format, and they redacted specific information from the cables that they didn't want us to see, mainly having to do with the location of the detention site at the time, some names of CI personnel that were in the
cables. So heavy black marker.
Heavy black markers, right, exactly. So they were printed. This early investigation, this is printed paper that we went through and thousands of pages.
And you walk in and to just set the scene a little bit. Mm-hmm. Where are you? What does the room look like? And what do you see in front of you when you walk in the room?
Sure. This initial investigation was largely done at CI headquarters. We had two rooms where I did the review. One was a sort of a, honestly, like a closet about maybe 6 feet by 6 feet. They would bring in the binders. I would sit down with a notepad. And we weren't able to take really specific notes, but we could take sort of broad notes and sketches of what was in the documents. That changed a little bit as the review went on. So that was one location. And then, you know, I did this over nights and weekends with my other colleague. And the other location was the CIA Operations Center. They would just put me in there from, you know, 10 p.m. at night till 3 in the morning type deal. And I would just go through all the records at that period of time. I mean, I had another job on the committee. I still had my counterterrorism duties at that time and my other oversight duties. So I basically did myself and my Senate colleague. We did this a lot in the evenings and weekends.
And how quickly did it seem like you were reading something important?
Pretty quickly. I mean, the cables were significant immediately. It was very clear that what they had told the committee and what the public knew was very different than what was in those cables. There was a series of memos prepared for the president in July of 2002 mm-hmm. to describe waterboarding and the other techniques that were planned. That memo went through a series of revisions where they kept taking out techniques. And then eventually...
And you know this because you saw the revisions in the memo?
Absolutely, yeah. So some of the among the 6.3 million pages that the CIA produced for us were any draft you might have, right? So on your computer, you may have 20 drafts of a document. Mm-hmm. So that's something we could see. We could see, here's a memo prepared for the president on July 1, and it has waterboarding. The version on July 10th, they drop waterboarding and they just say, walling and shackling and other hard procedures. And then, say, July 20th, the memo says, procedures that are legal but not used by law enforcement.
So back to the chronology then.
Sure, yeah.
You're in the cables. The cables themselves begin to show you something different from what you expected to see.
Right.
What was that?
Well, one of the first things we learned looking at the Abu Zubaydah cables related to the tapes destruction was that he was initially captured and interrogated by FBI interrogators who acquired quite a bit of information from him using rapport-building techniques. The CIA slowly ratcheted up the pressure on Abu Zubaydah with sleep deprivation, noise, nudity, etc. The FBI left. Abu Zubaydah was placed in isolation without anyone asking him any questions for 47 days. That's certainly not a ticking time bomb situation. No one's asking him any questions. During that period of time, the CIA was seeking legal approval to use these advanced enhanced interrogation techniques. Once they obtained those techniques, they immediately began using them 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, nonstop. Within the first 6 hours of interrogating Abu Zubaydah using those techniques, he was waterboarded. He was waterboarded 83 times, at least 83 times. One of the things we've learned about subsequently is that not all the records of the CIA are complete. We found a lot more information in instant messages between CIA officers and emails and others. But even in those official cables, we could see that the program varied. It was drastically different than described. On the other end, at headquarters, that was not the understanding. Their understanding was that the techniques would produce information that would stop plots and identify operatives in the United States. That clearly did not happen at all, and we learned that from the cables. So we saw the misinformation being provided to the White House, even during the tapes investigation.
Was it also because of this question of efficacy?
The CIA representative over a period of years that their enhanced interrogation techniques met the legal approvals, that they in fact produced otherwise unique information that saved lives. And we looked at the 20 most prominent examples, right? And these are examples that the CIA took to the Department of Justice and Congress later in the White House and said, see, this program works. And we looked at 6.3 million pages of records. And the point of that was to confirm, just to confirm what they said was accurate. And what we found was a very different story with each of those 20 cases. They just don't hold up. And that includes the operation that led to Osama bin Laden. That, to me, was one of the more disturbing aspects of this project. When we began, we thought this was maybe a problem that was under the CIA, just under the Bush administration. But obviously, the operation on bin Laden happened under the Obama administration. We were seeing the CIA mislead the White House again, misleading Congress and misleading the public.
So you are working in an offsite location. You're going through millions of pages.
Sure.
But at some point you realize some of those pages are no longer there, things you'd seen before and somehow are off the server. How did you realize that, and what did it look like it happened?
Right. So it happened on two occasions in 2010 where batches of documents that we knew we had suddenly disappeared off our server, hundreds of documents.
And you knew what they said and they were useful.
Yes, they were extremely useful documents. Partly we noticed because they were useful. I had a policy of printing out important things, right? Mm-hmm. So if it was important, I printed it out and put it in a file somewhere, right? Eventually, the whole room was filled with paper. Mm-hmm. But in this case, when I went to go find the electronic version, or a colleague of mine went to go look for an electronic version, it was gone. And this happened twice. And again, we notified the CIA about it. They blamed it, said it was an IT mistake. And we drilled down a little bit further, and they said, no, the White House told us to remove those documents because they might be subject to executive privilege. Senator Feinstein called the White House. The White House denied giving the CIA that order. Mm-hmm. They apologized to Senator Feinstein, said it would never happen again. And that was the end of that. And it was later in 2010 which we discovered this document, which we called the Panetta Review. CIA director at the time, Leon Panetta, said, I mean, the Senate Intelligence Committee, I've just negotiated terms of this major investigation they're doing. Mm-hmm. And I want to know, as CIA director, what are they going to find? It's a completely legitimate inquiry. Mm-hmm. And he set up a team, apparently, to go through the documents in parallel as we were going through the documents. So he wouldn't be surprised.
A shadow second team.
Sure. A shadow second team. So when we found the Panetta Review, and the Panetta Review was placed on our server, at the time it was just a huge relief for myself and my colleagues because, as I mentioned, the tapes investigation that looked at Abu Zubaydah and al-Nashiri really uncovered some incredibly disturbing details about the CIA program. Once we got access to far greater information, we kept identifying more and more disturbing details to the point that, you know, we were questioning ourselves. Like, what's going on here? I mean, it was that bad.
What do you mean? What do you mean you're...
Well, I mean, you know, the unauthorized use of techniques, misinformation to the president and to the Department of Justice. I think the working assumption was the program would have gotten better, right? They would have fixed the lapses. It would become more professional. It didn't happen. It only got worse.
Meaning and the same techniques were being used.
Well, not even the same techniques. I mean, it was off the reservation. They were using techniques that were never approved by Department of Justice. They were capturing individuals which they had very little information about. I mean, the CIA acknowledges to this day, you know, there is at least 119 CIA detainees. 26 of them, the CIA admits, were wrongfully detained, never should have been detained under their authorities. That's not our assessment. That's the CIA's assessment. So that's the type of thing, you know, we're coming across a mentally challenged man who is detained merely because his brother is detained. And they're detaining him to put pressure on someone else. We're seeing people with injuries to their legs being forced to stand. We're seeing things like rectal rehydration and rectal feeding of detainees with no medical need. They're described as, you know, basically methods that show you have total control of a detainee. So these are the types of things we're coming across, and it's getting worse and worse. So when the Panetta Review appears on our servers, it was a relief to us. It was like a red team, right? It's like, here's a parallel group looking at the same documents we're looking at.
And they're seeing
the same things, right?
Who wrote it?
A small team that Director Panetta put together.
just regular staffers.
Yeah, they're certainly CIA personnel. When we did find the review, to us it was reassuring. You know, we're not crazy. Here's CIA people finding that the CIA misled the Department of Justice, the CIA misled the president, that they were engaged in these sort of heinous acts that were far outside of the program.
And they're highlighting it as sort of matter-of-factly.
Absolutely. In the same way that, you know, very similar, like, on this date, this happened, on this date, this happened. In some ways, they're even more aggressive than we were in the Senate report. Senator Feinstein needed, and rightfully so, she told us never to put anything in that report that we don't have multiple sources for. If we're not sure about an allegation, it doesn't go in. They were less careful in the Panetta review.
How long was it?
It's thousands of pages, maybe over 1,000 pages.
And at some point, you started worrying that maybe you would no longer be able to see it?
Well, we printed it out like we print out any important document when we found it. It only became important once we submitted the report to the CIA and to the White House for comment. Because then they came back and they said, well, you know, this is filled with errors. This is wrong. This is wrong. That never happened, which I'm still dumbfounded about because we cite, you know, there's 38,000 footnotes in the full report. And those footnotes are to CIA's records.
One day you decide you're taking the review or part of the review out of this lockdown location that's offsite. And at some point you decide you need to actually go around the system. How did that happen?
Sure. I had been personally advocating for us, the committee, to relocate the document for safekeeping for some time. I don't remember what the actual moment was in which we decided that this was something that we needed to do. I remember it happening at about 1 or 2 in the morning, and that was not uncommon. I mean, this was a 7-day-a-week gig for many years. You know, it was not uncommon for us to be there until 2 or 3 in the morning. And, you know, we're caught in this trap because the White House is taking the position that pretty much whatever the CIA says, they're going to go with. And we are having issues getting serious individuals to take a serious look at our findings. And, you know, the Panetta Review is one of those extra arrows we had now to say and prove that the CIA had been misleading folks about their program, including the current administration.
Nevertheless, were you allowed to do it?
No.
Did you fear that it would be undermined by you going around the system? I mean,
there were documents disappearing off the server. They had destroyed videotapes, evidence of the program. They had misled the president. They had misled the Department of Justice and they misled Congress. Now we had this one paper document in a CIA facility. Frankly, we were more terrified that it would disappear.
Did you see Zero Dark 30?
I did. Saw Zero Dark 30 with Senator Feinstein at the Motion Picture Association here in Washington, D.C.
At their premiere?
It was a small showing for myself, Senator Feinstein, and maybe 5 or 10 others in a small room. It was Senator Chris Dodd, former Senator Chris Dodd, was then chairman of the NPA.
And what was it like? Did the senator know going in what the storyline would be?
No, I don't recall us having any idea what would be in the story, but obviously we had been working on this for a while. I don't know how the invitation came to her. Maybe it was former Senator Dodd who reached out to her. Mike Linton, who was president of Sony Pictures, just happened to be there that day, which is unfortunate for him. But we went in and watched the beginning. I think Senator Feinstein got up and left after 20 minutes. I followed her, and again, Mike Linton happened to be in the hallway at the time, and she expressed her deep regrets about the content of the film and how it had been quite misleading.
Do you think that the film had an impact on public response or public understanding of the torture program?
Absolutely. Films like this have a profound cultural impact. You know, I can still remember the scene. I think I've seen it. You know, I walked out once with Senator Feinstein. I think I watched it another time. Where is Bin Laden? And they're torturing someone, right? And this guy yells out Kuwaiti or something. Mm-hmm. And it looks like it's supposed to be Ammar al-Baluchi, who's one of the CIA detainees. And it came out later that the CIA, one of the individuals who was involved in that interrogation was one of the people that talked to Bowl and Miss Bigelow. That just was all false.
One of the things that I kept thinking about before you came in was that it seems as though there's been a national conversation of some kind Does it feel that way to you at that moment?
You know, I was very disappointed with how ex-former CIA officials reacted to the release of the report. I was very disappointed with how the White House, the Obama White House, reacted to the release of the report. This is a moment that really called for leadership. The Senate did our work. We did the right thing. You know, we followed the facts. We needed others to do their job, and they didn't.
If you were disappointed by the last White House, what happens when first candidate Trump and then, you know, professes interest in torture on the campaign trail and then, as president, nominates someone who's been part of the system? Does it repudiate the work you did? Does it peel it back?
Well, as you know, the CIA aggressively campaigned for Gina Haspel to be CIA director, you know, using their Twitter account. Former CIA officials, many who were involved in this program, advocated for her to be CIA director. And it does. It does lift a cloud off of them to have the U.S. Senate say, despite the CIA officer's involvement in this program, we are still going to confirm her for the most senior level position at the Central Intelligence Agency. And I'm disappointed by that. Over and over again, individuals who are found to be engaged in wrongdoing at the agency are not held accountable. Instead, they're promoted and allowed to move up the ranks. And that just simply wouldn't happen in any other private agency or public agency that has any sunlight. You can do that type of thing in an organization where you can compartment information and say it's secret and you can't see this. And other people were saying misinformation. They've been repeating misinformation for years about something really important to our country. And we knew it to be false.
And the falsehood is that it's not saving lives, or the falsehood is that we're not using these techniques?
The falsehood is how we use the techniques, what they produced. And, you know, we may have lost the TV debate on this, but all of the information is there in the redacted executive summary. I mean, granted, there are 6,700 pages with 38,000 footnotes that remains classified, but that 500-page summary that is out there with thousands of footnotes to CIA's records, it's all there for those who care to take the time to read it. And the lack of accountability there that we see will continue to haunt the agency and haunt our country until someone stands up and says, we've got to pull this together. We've got to make sure that, you know, I don't think personally that people should be going to jail, but maybe instead of CIA director, you're involved in a torture program. Maybe, you know, this is a good time for you to be in charge of the parking facility. Like, I don't know what that is, but there has to be some accountability.
There was a lot of resistance to making that report public. And there were opponents who said that it was going to endanger lives of Americans globally, that it would be a national security disaster. And across the board, a bipartisan group of people, including Senator Kerry, saying this would be a mistake. Why did you push so hard?
Well, first of all, I'm a staffer. Mm-hmm. It's senators who make decisions, and I can't fully represent what their thoughts were, but I think I can try. They felt really strongly that what the United States had done was wrong and wasn't who we are. You know, we have gone through many wars without prosecuting others for torture, right? George Washington made the decision not to torture, saying, you know, we're better than that. That's not who we are. During World War II, we brought German soldiers to the Midwest of the United States, and they lived on farms. Our prisoners of war were being tortured. And they felt as if the United States was a leader in human rights and that this was inconsistent, and that the only way to correct that was to tell the world what we did and say it won't ever happen again.
Daniel Jones, thank you so much for coming into the studio.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Foreign Policy's The ER Podcast. I'm Sarah Wildman, and I've been your host. The podcast is produced by Shelby Bosted and Dan Efron. Our editor this week was Rob Sachs. For more information about Foreign Policy and to subscribe to The ER, please visit foreignpolicy.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.